CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Sego. Bonjour, Anim.
Danach A. At Anzani Shukwithan.
Tante.
Ay, Inuhadikai.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Hello, listener. I'm so glad you found your way here. This is Words and Culture, and I'm your host, Melissa Spence, for the Anishinaabe episodes. Obviously, I'm Anishinaabe. But if you need to get caught up on where we are and who we are in this series, please check us out at wordsandculture.ca. The internet is simultaneously wonderful and horrible for me. When the pandemic hit, I was living in Arizona. And when the borders closed and the reality had sunk in that I wouldn't be able to visit my family for who knows how long, I was hit with what seemed like relentless waves of depression and even fear. My only comfort was the strong internet connection I had to FaceTime my folks and friends, tap into live streams, and eventually, during all my searching and streaming, I noticed that more and more knowledge keepers were getting on platforms like Instagram and Facebook to share the culture. I saw virtual beading circles, healing circles, musical jamborees, or just people hanging out on Zoom trying to keep the bond of community strong. One of the content creators who stood out for me was James Volkolich, a super friendly guy with a soothing voice, and more importantly, a genuine passion I was able to detect immediately with regards to Anishinaabe Moin. He was posting short videos called Ojibwe Word of the Day. Fast forward to today, he's released his first book, The Seven Generations and the Seven Grandfather Teachings. He's a world-renowned speaker, digital creator, with well over 100,000 followers on Instagram and over 22,000 on TikTok. And I have to admit, I was a little starstruck during this interview. It was weeks in the making. So as we do on Words and Culture, I asked James to introduce himself.
Aho, bujo indenoi maknaduk. Anin, kage gabo indishinakas. Mikanak indudem. Mikanak wajawing indunjaba. Beishoka kabakang indanongong. And what I said there was a traditional Ojibwe protocol greeting. I said, hello, all of my relatives. My name is Kage Gabo. I'm also James Vuklich. I'm Turtle Clan. I'm a descendant of Turtle Mountain, and I live close to Minneapolis today, Kakabakong, the place of the falls. And I wanted to take a moment and say thank you all for listening. I really appreciate it.
Wow, I'm Turtle Clan as well. What an honor.
Gidinawainman. We're related.
So I discovered you during the pandemic. I'm a millennial, borderline millennial, and your videos popped up on my feed doing the Ojibwe word of the day. And that's how I was introduced to you. How did you end up creating the word of the day? Like, what led you to your online journey, first of all?
Well, first, Miigwech Bizendalian, thanks for listening. I really appreciate that. I never know who I'm speaking to because I'm usually speaking to a phone. And even before that, I mean, the journey of Word of the Day, it starts when I began publishing these small little videos while I was working with Indian education here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And what I wanted to do was just take a moment to share one word in Ojibwe for people who are online as they were listening, as they were scrolling, as they were catching up with friends and checking out news. And the first ones had links to a dictionary file, so someone could click the button and hear a fluent first language speaker pronounce the word for them, which I thought was really cool. But a lot of people weren't doing that, clicking the link, and were saying, oh, you have to pronounce the word. And that's when I began making these small movies after I had put my infant son to bed. I would sit on the couch and wait. Maybe he would get up or need help. And while I was doing that, I would put together a small video that I would post online. When this new feature called Facebook Live came out, my wife challenged me to try saying something, try getting on live and doing a little word of the day, which I did. And that was surprisingly popular. I had been expecting to maybe speak to 100 or 200 people if I were lucky, and that would have been a grand success. But my first time out, I spoke to tens of thousands of people. which I wasn't expecting, about one of my favorite moons, the Suckerfish moon. And as that developed, there were all of these jewels in Anishinaabemowin, in the Ojibwe language, that I had always wanted a chance to discuss outside of a classroom setting. And again, with the live feature and with, the advent of technology and social media, that gave me a platform and a place to speak to people about some of the things I find absolutely beautiful about the language.
In your book, The Seven Generations and the Seven Grandfather Teachings, you share your connection to Anishinaabemowin. It began in your 20s. And what was that time like for you? And what was there like a catalyst or a significant event that led you to that? Or was it just a gradual progression for you?
I had originally intended to study film and video. So I had done film and video at City College here in Minneapolis. I decided I wasn't into that. I mean, I loved it, but it wasn't my vocation. And I was seeking out my vocation, something I really wanted to do. It would pay off years later when I began making small videos that I would post daily. I used a lot of those teachings that I had learned in film and video. I discovered the French language as well. And so I had originally moved to Quebec for an immersion experience to study in French immersion at the University de Québec à Trois-Rivières. I studied there for a year. I came back to the States with every intention of becoming a French teacher. And I needed to take another course to get my financial aid package to qualify for grants, loans, and I saw Ojibwe was being offered. Now, my mother's Ojibwe, my grandmother's Ojibwe, and I thought, I've studied French, some Italian, even a little bit of Latin in middle school. Should I give this language a try? And I remember that first semester, that first course I took. I had heard the most fascinating story about myself I had never been told, and it was through the language. And despite having moved to another country to learn another language, I went all in Ojibwe. It was the most elegant and sophisticated and complex language I had ever run across. And again, it was telling me the story about myself. And so I didn't look back. I went all in.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Your book really broke down not just the interconnectedness of all of our relatives, but the way our language is also interconnected in that same way. And I've never heard anybody break it down like that. So it was really mind-boggling for me. How did you begin to grasp the language and its spiritual translation with regards to the generational meanings?
What I was so fortunate when I went to school for Ojibwe. Again, I didn't grow up with the language. I didn't hear it until I was a 25-year-old man. So my approach had to be different than someone who grew up in a community where they heard it on a daily basis or even had people in their household who spoke it. Mine became both listening to elders, having them describe what the words meant to them, as well as a scientific process. When I went back to school after teaching at University of Minnesota, I went to grad school in linguistics, which is the scientific study of language. And there I had an opportunity to work on the Ojibwe People's Dictionary, which is a landmark in indigenous lexicography. It is an amazing resource, and it is still growing as we speak, as well as having a chance with working with who I consider the world's leading linguistic expert in the Ojibwe language. So I would listen to elders describe what these words meant, and then I was able to really scientifically look at the morphemes, look at the structure of the language, the morphosyntax, if you will, and get an understanding, a clear understanding of what was actually embedded in the words, what the words were actually saying. There are so many people who have had my experience, who had no exposure to the language or culture growing up. How can I use the science that I've had a chance to learn in graduate school, as well as the traditional teachings I've had an opportunity to learn from elders, fluent first language speakers, medicine people, hereditary chiefs. How can I share that with people in a way that's compelling and understandable as well? And so those became my first steps on how can I really understand what's going on in some of these beautiful words that we use on a daily basis.
And why was it important to you to work on the Ojibwe Language Dictionary Project? And what were some of its challenges, if there were any?
Oh, lexicography provides a vast array of challenges. One of the fun parts I liked working on it was the technology had changed. So when I first started learning the language, there were two dictionaries available for the dialect I use. There was the Baraga Dictionary, which had been written in the mid-1800s, published in the later 1800s, and had used the an orthography writing system that we do not use any longer. And the other book was the Concise Dictionary of Minnesota Ojibwe, which is an amazing work, but it's small, it's concise. And when you're learning a new language, you need more than a concise dictionary. So with the new technology, especially with it being online, there was an opportunity to watch the concise dictionary grow into something that if it were published today, I mean, it would be a tome about this big. And it's growing because it's online, it's digital. People can continue to add to it. And there was this other cool feature that I thought was amazing. And maybe you've had this experience too. If you had, as you've maybe looked at the language, some of these words are really long. I remember opening up my first Ojibwe language book, Portage Lake by the late Maud Keg, seeing the word Ishkwa Manomina Kewad, which was most of the page when it was written down, and asking myself, how will I ever pronounce this? How will I ever figure out how to use this? And the People's Dictionary, you can find sound files. And this was mainly my job while I was a grad student, was editing the sound files of fluent first language speakers who are pronouncing the words, using them in sentence examples. And now with the click of a button on our cell phones, we can listen to people who are no longer with us share their language, share their knowledge with us. So it was the importance of documenting the language, documenting those voices for people I may never see, speak to, listen to, or hold became something really important. That was very important. And then for challenges, it is finding people who are often older, who are able to work for periods of time and be able to record the words that we want to share with the world. And so at the time that was one of the challenges, but I'm delighted that 13 years later, after I'd left grad school and had left that part of the academy, that it's still growing, that it's still thriving. And I really applaud the people who are working on it now.
So what's been your favorite experience thus far with your language journey?
There are a handful of standout moments. You know, one of the most profound came at the very beginning, and it really gave me direction to where I was going with in my life. It became kind of a goal. One that I didn't know if I would ever reach, and I still don't think I have, but it's one I enjoy reaching for. I was harvesting wild rice in Nigagoon Sminikoning, Red Gut First Nation in northwestern Ontario. We were in a trapline cabin. We had to canoe there. We had been processing Manomin wild rice that day. There was no electricity. There was no running water. The cabin was lit by a kerosene lamp. And that night I would sleep in a bajishkogan, a teepee. But while we were there, one of the elders from a community that was a little north of there, he was my friend's namesake. And so we got a nice pile of tobacco that we offered to him and asked him questions. And one person asked about the Madodo Swan, about the Swat Lodge, and he went on to deliver a hour and 45 minute talk, perfectly bilingual, on the spirituality and the culture around the Sweat Lodge. And it was a lecture that he had done live. He had not prepared for it. And it was one that could have been delivered at Harvard, at the Sorbonne, at Yale. And I thought, I would love to be able to talk about the culture, about the history, about the spirituality, someday like that, completely extemporaneous. And that was a pretty cool moment as a young man in college beginning to learn my language. That was outstanding. There were other moments where I have been with friends, having laughs. Those, they're passing and fleeting. But there were some moments when we've told a joke in the language and we actually got it. And we had done it with each other and we were second language learners. That was a big moment. We had done this in an immersion classroom with someone who had misspoken. And we had riffed on that. And it was, that was very fun. Having done talks, sharing the language and the culture, the history, the spirituality embedded in it, I've had numerous occasions where people have approached me and said, you know, I didn't grow up with the language either. I had no one to go and speak to. And all of a sudden, I had a chance to listen to your videos. I had a chance to read your book or come to the talk. And it changed the way I looked at myself. It changed the way I looked at the world. And those moments are very humbling. But I deeply appreciate those too. Those have been magic moments where it wasn't almost what I had learned. It was also what I was able to give back, where I felt true and genuine joy in working with the language and the culture.
I didn't really understand what language keepers meant when they said, we don't have a word for that, or this phrase gets lost in the translation to English. And I'm really coming to terms now as an older person, how much I've missed out. And I've even heard this statement, you can't have a full understanding of what it is like to be Anishinaabe without the language. Do you agree with that statement, or is it too black and white?
It's a nuanced view. I think the best views are, because you can absolutely, I think, have an understanding of what it means to be a human being without speaking fluent Anishinaabe Mon. Without speaking the language fluently. In fact, maybe you can speak the language fluently and not understand some of the insights that are in the language. Like, we have a number of words in English that have a really deep history that we just use casually on an everyday basis without really understanding their history or what they really mean, where those words came from, and the stories behind them. However, I think what those most of the time can... it can get lost in translation. Maybe if the people who are saying those things were ESL speakers. And there, I've met a number of those people who grew up with Anishinaabe Mon as their first language and had learned English later. I think with the language, what we see is a 13,000-year investment in us. I wonder what our ancestors said when they knew that there were people they would never see, speak to, listen to, or hold. Someone not just seven generations, maybe 14 or 28 generations away. And asking themselves, well, what would we give to them? What would we share with them? Share maybe how to lead a good life. Life of peace, life of balance. Life without conflict with your ecosystem, your environment, or your relatives. A holistic life. A life without contradiction. How will we pass these teachings down? We'll put them in the language. And we've seen case after case in history where there have been civilizations and cultures, the great deal of knowledge, great deal of wisdom, who have maybe written these down in books, carved them into stone. You look at hieroglyphs. And at one point in history, that knowledge is lost. It's gone. We no longer know how to read the hieroglyphs, or we have to relearn how to read those. Sometimes we'll even forget what language they're written in. Books can be destroyed and burned. And I think with the language we have, when I say a 13,000-year investment in us, we've scientifically proven that We speak for the same reason that we see, touch, hear, taste, or smell. As human beings, we're hardwired to do this. We're hardwired to use language. And I think, and I have to say I think, because no one can speak definitively about this, that when asked, well, how will we pass these teachings down generation after generation? The ingenious idea they had was we will put the teachings in the words themselves. And it's the way a culture with a really strong oral tradition can pass down a myriad of teachings, literally over millennia, to generations who are coming. When they look in the words and really describe, find out what the words mean. For me, when I do that, I can hear my ancestors' voices speaking to me. We went through this too. We had a point in our life where we asked, what does it mean to be humble? How do I treat my relatives with respect? What does it really mean to be to love and to be loved? How do I show strength of heart in times when I have to make really difficult decisions, when I need to be brave? And when we had this experience, we shared it. We put that meaning into the word itself. And so when you have that experience, you can look in the language and it can describe it to you. It was one of those moments where when I first began learning the language and offering tobacco to elders and fluent first language speakers asking for help in it, they would tell me time and time again that if you really want to know the culture, the history, the spirituality, the ethics, the philosophy, the history, it's all in the language. And because I'm slow, it takes me about 2 years to realize, oh, wait, it's literally in the language and something that all human beings use.
I've interviewed recently a elder who is helping to translate the Star Wars films into Anishinaabe Mo'in. Where do you have any dreams for the language, or do you have any long-term goals, or where do you want to see all of this go in the future generations?
My long-term goals are humble, yet they are they're humble at best. I'd like to do my best to pass the language or whatever I have learned onto the next generation. Some of these efforts, like Star Wars, that's a really innovative and cool effort, because I think I can recount Star Wars line for line, and I have been able to for the last 25 years. You're going to have a number of people who are going to watch it and be like, oh, that's how you say, you know, may the force be with you. It's going to be really fun to watch. It's going to be really even more fun to listen to. I would love to just be able to pass it down to the next generation, hopefully with more resources than I had when I began learning the language and with more opportunity to do it. When I first started learning the language, your choice was university courses. And while I was doing that, I was listening to cassette tapes and photocopies of books. There were no textbooks at the time. So to be able to pass down resources for the next generation, that if they make the choice to pass down what they have learned, then that's my main ambition. That's my main goal with the language.
At the end of every interview, I always get my guests to teach me three words. Before I do that, though, do you have any phrases that you absolutely love in the language, or any particular structures?
Shall I teach you some of them?
I would love to. Do that? Yes.
Let's do top three. All right. Maybe top four. Let's do it four. Four is a very important number in the culture. The first one would be Shawena Mishinam. The first time out, well done. Gimeno Tagos. You sound good. That word, Shawenam, it's a beautiful word in the language. It means to have compassion for. It means to bless. And it means to love unconditionally. Now, when you put the Ishinam at the end of it, it means all of us. To say Shawenam Ishinam at the end of a ceremony, and often you'll hear it four times, means please bless. Please have unconditional love. And please have compassion for all of us, all of my relatives. It's a very beautiful way to end a ceremony. That's basic. That's one. Are you ready for the next one?
I am. My mind is being blown right now.
This is one that I just absolutely love. Kijewatsi. Kijewatsi. Nice. That kije, it's like unconditional loving kindness. And the traditional word, name for God, it's not the spirit or creator's name, but it's the one that would be used maybe in ceremony with great reverence. Wasn't great spirit Gichi Manadu? It was Kije Manadu. Kind spirit, benevolent mystery. So that Kije, when it is added to that word, Kije Watsi, it means he or she lives with that kind of kindness, with that loving kindness, with that generosity. And it shows me, this is a big one for me, because there was no longer a dichotomy between like spirit and human being. It was human beings can seek to have that kind of loving, that love in their lives. And we know it because they had found a word that describes to live with that kindness. In when I meditate and set down a Sema tobacco at the end of every day, I will ask for Dagawidu Kawashanam, please help all of us. To help each other to lead lives of kindness. And so I absolutely love that word for kindness, for living that way, for living that life.
Amazing. Kijewatsi.
Nice. Even the tagos. Again, you sound great. You're natural.
Thank you. Thank you. Omigwech,
kick in. There is one that I've been sharing at the end that during my talks, when I do keynotes, and I've been delighted and fortunate to travel to a number of communities in Anishinaabe King in Ojibwe country. And I've made it a point to teach people this since the pandemic, because so many of us, you know, lost people we hold very dear to us, people we love very dearly. And so if you want to say, I love you to someone in Ojibwe, you can always say, Gizagi'in. Gizagi'in.
Gizagi.
I love you.
Gizagi'in. Yes. Gizagi'in.
And then we used Jawainam earlier. Jawainam Anishinaabe. You can also say, Gizhawainamin.
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 I love you. So I make a point to say that to my son every day when I drop him off at school. I have the privilege to do that. So it's Gigawabman. We don't have a set word for goodbye. It's Gigawabman. I'll see you later. Gishuwenaman. I love you.
Thank you.
And then I suppose our fourth word, we'll do four. It's a mystic number in Anishinaabe culture. Miigwech.
Miigwech.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Apajigo Miigwech. Thank you very much for having me on today.
I have to give big props to Kim Wheeler for getting James on the show today. He's a super in-demand guy, and to be honest, I thought it wasn't going to happen. But it did. I guess you can say the Creator works in incredible ways. I now know what a journey James has been on to reach the point that he's at today. And not only am I looking forward to his next book, that'll be picking up where the first left off, on transforming your life, I'm actually inspired to practice the good life, or Minamibatsuin, to stay in balance and not be in contradiction, to live in peace and walk the talk. It's a lot harder than it sounds. I'm also grateful for Indigenous content creators like him who are compassionate and kind. The internet can be a harsh reflection of what's happening in our world, but it can also be a place for learning. Chi Miigwech to you for joining us on this episode. Your support and love is deeply appreciated. I'm going to head out and do some more reflecting, and I'll be back with our final installment of the Anishinaabe episodes very soon. Until then, Nagaj, or later.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e. Ninen yuji hina.
Ekose.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.